folks. Welcome to this week's podcast. On the show with me is Dave Holmes, actor, host, someone that I've been a fan of and excited to have on the show because I've been watching you for, you know, since, I don't want to date you too much, but the late 90s when you were a VJ at MTV. So welcome to the show, man. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, man. Thank you for having me, Paul.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm a fan of your work as well. This is great.
Thanks. I want people to know you have a great weekly column for Vulture, very funny, very insightful. You're
Thank
also
you.
Hosting a panel game show podcast called International Waters for Maximum
Correct.
Fun. And you're about to
yep.
start a gay-themed podcast for Nerdist called What
yeah.
We Talk About. And what's going to kind of obviously gay-themed, but like what's the focus
right.
of that podcast going to be?
Well, you know what something I've realized as I've gotten older and as I've sort of, you know, I'm in my 40s now and it's, you know, when you get up in years a little bit, you start to have sort of deeper conversations with your friends and you start to be more honest about, you know, your life and the, you know, and this is, I think also just like the benefit of therapy also, you start to sort of take a look at the narrative of your life a little bit.
Right.
And one thing that I've found in common with my gay friends is that we all sort of came out. And when you come out, when you have to, you know, go through that sort of grueling process with your family and with your friends, you always sort of want to do it from a place of like of strength. So you're always like, hey, I'm gay, everything's fine, and you don't need to worry about me, and I love it, and it's great, and it's all fine, you know.
Right.
And then you sort of rush yourself past the scary parts and the tricky parts and the unpleasant bits of it. And even with each other, I think in our younger days, we're not honest about it because nobody wants to be perceived as weak or needy or anything like that. So,
so you're saying there's kind of a transition period from being in the closet to coming
mm-hmm.
out, and then you've got to sort of, you yourself and the people around you need to sort of get your head around the transition period that takes to happen.
Right. Yeah, and I think we all have similar experiences, you know, in our first romantic relationships, in our sort of, you know, pre-coming out sort of crushes, there are common themes, I think, that weave through our lives, and somehow in the wide world of podcasts, there's no place for these. I mean, you know, there are a lot of great, there, you know, Dan and Varney has the JV Club and Dave Ross has Terrified and there's Mental Illness Happy Hour with Paul Gilmartin. And there are places where it's, you know, people are kind of talking about their experiences and their vulnerabilities and whatever, but there's no specifically sort of gay themed one. And I figure I better rush in and grab it before somebody else does. So that's what I'm doing.
By the way, instead of reading up on you, there's a quote, a tweet that you put out there that was
yeah.
highlighted by somebody after gay marriage was approved in New York, which was a really, really a great tweet. It says, as we celebrate today, let's spare a warm thought for our opponents who have lost absolutely nothing. It's like
an
insightful thing. And how frustrating...
You know,
has that been, you know, in seeing this fight for gay marriage? And now that it's sort of seeming to turn the corner, you know, how has that been
yeah.
for somebody like yourself?
Well, you know, it's funny, that particular, like, that tweet, for whatever reason, like, sometimes you just say something and people, like, respond to it, which is,
right.
And you're never sure exactly what it's going to be. That one sort of seemed to go everywhere. And there was this Catholic columnist for some sort of, you know, local Catholic newspaper who seized on that and was like, you know, oh, but you're wrong, Mr. Holmes, and wrote this long column about like everything that people who defend, you know, quote unquote traditional marriage are really losing. And I was like, you know what, I think this is a good opportunity to like actually talk to somebody who I don't think is a cruel or an awful person or like personally bigoted or whatever. I just think, you know, he's wrong. So I found the guy's email and we had like what I would consider a long and kind of productive conversation about it, which I'm really glad happened. And I don't think I changed his mind. You know, I think eventually he's going to see, because, you know, the dominoes are falling and it's, you know, it's done, basically.
Yeah.
So his kids are going to grow up in a world where their gay friends get married just like they do, or they're gay themselves or whatever. And I think he's going to see that there's really no downside to it. And everything that I, you know, I kind of try to hold his feet to the fire a little bit and say, like, you know, no, specifically, what is it that you're losing? What, Like, what did he, tell me
and
how.
What did he say? Did he say anything that, you know, it's nice that you had that conversation, and the goal is for him to kind of get a better understanding of where you're coming from, but also you get a better understanding of where somebody with that sort of very entrenched position is coming from. Do you think you opened his eyes to anything, and what was his issue?
No, what was his issue with it? Everything that he said was at stake was conceptual. You know what I mean? Like the idea of the desirability of like heterosexuality is out the window, which is crazy. Like you're straight if you're straight and you're gay if you're gay. You don't fucking lose anything. What I was trying to make him see, and I don't know if I was successful, is exactly that. That everything that he says he loses is just ephemeral anyway. It's not real. These are all just sort of concepts that he's gonna, and if he believes them, then he can continue to believe them, and he doesn't really lose anything. It's just, the conversation kind of petered out. But I think more than anything, I wanted to take the opportunity because I kind of got the feeling that this guy wasn't going to be some like screaming, frothing hater. And I know that I'm not that way. And I thought it would just be a constructive thing to say, hey, why don't we be grown-ups and actually talk to one another about it and not call each other names and not get snippy and shitty with each other, but actually be grown-up, have a conversation, because that is another thing that people aren't doing. There's a lot of people are hot under the collar on both sides.
Yeah, I go on a lot of the cable news shows as a, pundit, satirist, whatever, and, people talking over each other and really reciting talking points. It's like Westworld, and they get a giant key put in their back somewhere out in Queens, somewhere in an airport hangar, and then they get wound up and they're handed a script and they read their 8 talking on both sides,
absolutely.
And nobody's absolutely. Really sort of, no one wants to compromise in the conversation. Nobody wants to sort of truly sort of engage in somebody else's point of view and maybe say, maybe there is some merit to what that Republican said, and maybe there is some merit to what that Democrat said. It's just this noise.
Nobody's learning.
People like you or I, or the comedic world in general comes in and sort of to kind of keep everybody honest a little bit,
I hope so.
When you first came on the scene, which was through the MTV contest, the Wanna Be a VJ contest in 98, were you out of the closet then,
I was. But it's, I was also like 50 pounds heavier, and you can't get anyone to be interested in your sexual orientation when you're a fat guy. It's just,
even in the gay community, you got to be slim and trim.
Especially in the gay community, and especially then. I think, now there's sort of a greater appreciation of different kinds of body types or whatever, but back then it was very,
So you weren't getting a lot of action. Like, you weren't getting a lot of action.
Paul? I was getting plenty of action. put me in a room and I can do it. But back then, it's weird to remember, but back then, if you wanted to come out or if you wanted to say anything about anything, you needed to do it through the press. You needed to get somebody to help you amplify your story. You needed to do an interview with a magazine or a newspaper or a radio show or whatever. Now there's Twitter and there's blogs and there's, podcasts and whatever. If it were like I was out, but I just couldn't get anyone to ask me the fucking question,
Yeah, well, that's what I was curious about. Yeah, because was MTV kind of, were they cool? I mean, because you were runner up and then went on to
kind of cool. They were completely cool. But it was, I think really the only conversation that I ever had with them about it, because I was, I would make comments on the air kind of a lot, but nobody ever picked up on it just because I think I didn't read physically or behaviorally as a gay person.
What kind of stuff would you say? What were you like? What were the
things? I would, anytime a 98 Degrees video came on, I made no bones about the fact that I had a massive crush on Jeff Timmons. But I think people just thought I was being funny or whatever. It was a really good
team player and a host, an MTV team player. But
exactly. Yeah, it just sort of slid. So that would be my advice to anybody who is trying, who's in the public eye, who's trying to stay in the closet. Just gain 50 pounds, and nobody will ever ask you a question about your sexuality. That's all you got to do.
I could see you in pre-interviews. Like, I'd like them to ask me about my sexual orientation. No, we're good. No, I want you to ask me. Like, I can see you getting like, yeah. So you have like
very strange.
You have this really great knowledge of music. You grew up in St. Louis.
Okay.
And that helped you apparently, you know, in sort of almost winning the contest, which in a sense you kind of did win because you went on with a great career at MTV a lot of different capacities. Where's the music passion come from? Did you aspiring musician at heart or from
no,
father,
you know,
father,
I,
brother?
My grandfather was in a vaudeville entertainer. He toured in a barbershop quartet and stuff. Also, I just learned performed in blackface, which I'm not too psyched about. This was all like back in the 20s when that was kind of, you know, when nobody understood how deeply offensive that was. And it was, you know, and he's a guy who I, you know, never died 20 years before I was born. But there's music and blackface in my blood. but not really. But also, I had the benefit of having older brothers who were much older and who started going off to college in like 78, 79 when sort of college radio started. Mm-hmm. So they would come back when I was 8 and 9, they would come back with crates of records that were like, you know, the Clash and the Sex Pistols and stuff that was just weird and nobody else my age knew about it. And I just sort of, that kind of became my drug sort of early. I just sort of dove into crates of records and that's been, you know, like I was never an exceptional student. I was never an exceptional athlete, but like once I started to really like dive into pop culture, it was sort of clear that was my lane, you know?
Was there had you had on camera experience before that contest? And then once you got the contest and got on the air, what was there? A big adjustment? Was like, whoa, this is a lot harder than it looks, or this is way easier than it looks?
You know, I had done a good amount of radio, like never professional radio, but I actually, when I was in high school, I lied and said that I was in college and got a college radio show. Mm-hmm. I like rode my bike to a campus nearby and just fibbed my way into like an on-air gig, and all through high school was a college radio DJ, which was fun, but it's still, you know, pretty loose. I had done a lot of improv and a lot of sort of sketch comedy and that kind of thing in college and the years after, but I had never hosted anything. Right. And I lucked into it. And the cool thing about MTV at that time was that they were really happy being kind of ramshackle. Like they really, you know, there were a few live shows, and if you made a mistake, then that was sort of part of the charm. It wasn't, nobody was trying to be perfect. Nobody was, you know,
it's true. I had Doug Herzog on my podcast, and you know, you probably know or worked with Lauren Correa over there in the day.
Oh, sure.
Lauren's a good old friend of mine, and Comedy Central too, to a certain extent, falls in this category. There was a time back then when there was a charm to it because there wasn't as much at stake, you know, and so.
Yeah,
I don't want to say they were new and fledgling, but they were newer than they were more established, and now they're more like the broadcast networks. And so, you know, we do stuff. I've worked on The Daily Show for a number of years, and we would just do stuff on The Daily Show just to see, like we did a thing with Monica Lewinsky, and she was rehabilitating her image. I don't know if you remember that point in her career. She had kind of come off all the hard stuff, and she had a handbag line. She was she did a Vanity Fair spread where the theme was a country girl, and she was sitting on a blanket. And we were so incensed, my writing partner and I, that she was getting this second chance after whatever. And you know, so we basically like said, you know, she's also doing milk endorsements, and we basically had him put a cum shot all over her face and said, yeah, milk underneath it. And they let us put it on the air. Like, what happened now, right? And so I know exactly what you're saying. There's sort of a charm to that I think is missed a little bit in cable. I don't know how you feel about it, but
sure, I totally agree. And I don't know if like the internet and podcasts are sort of swooping in and taking that or what. But it's I definitely miss that. And I don't think certainly, you know, the teenagers and the comedy fans who at least used to gravitate to MTV and Comedy Central like don't want something that's perfect.
Yeah.
For a few years I did a movie kind of interstitial show on FX where we would, you know, we would show Big Mama's House 2 or whatever and pop up a break
DVD,
and get the fact that
DVD on TV. Yeah, yeah.
I love watching
that show, yeah.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. And all through it, our producer was like such a stickler for having the framing of a shot be just right or like, you know, he would like, I don't like the way you're pointing your toes to my female co-host or whatever, and be such a, like a crazy sort of martinet about the whole thing that it was like, what the fuck is going on? Like, we don't need to be perfect. And nobody who's halfway through Big Mama's House 2 or whatever is going to be like, I am not happy with the way this woman is pointing her toes. I'm going to change the channel.
Right.
Yeah, you're either into the movie or you're not. And you know who you are. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You're not getting a lot of Columbia Film School grads, watching Big Mama. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Let's all chill out.
So once you were sort of locked into MTV, I mean, you kind of knew, you felt like you were in like the right place because it was a great opportunity for you to bring your knowledge of music and passion for pop culture into like the place.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
You know, we were playing music, you know, for it was the second I got there, it got very, like, the demographic dropped by like 10 years. You know what I mean? It got really, things got very teenage very quickly, you know? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't exactly my, although I did grow to love it, it wasn't exactly my style of music. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I still, you know, I guess I still got an opportunity to sort of get my perspective in there or whatever. Really the best thing about it was that so much of what you have to do when you're on air there is improvisational.
Yeah.
And I had to do a lot of stuff like in front of an audience where I'd have to vamp a whole lot and I'd have to sort of just make fun things happen. Like for the live shows, they would just send me out with a camera crew into Times Square and just say, make something funny happen. And that was like, that's really daunting, but it's also a great challenge. And I got really, really lucky. It was boot camp in the best possible way.
Did you ever have moments like either that didn't make it to air or that made it to air that were just kind of memorable fuck ups or screw ups or whatever?
You know, no, because they put everything on the air, you know, like there wasn't really time to mess around, you know? Almost everything made it onto the air. I would, on M2, which is now MTV2, I did some stuff on air for them too. And they were really like, they would put everything on the air. And there were times when I'd be doing a take and I knew I wasn't happy with my performance. And the only way to make them stop and start again would be to say fuck. So I would just have to do that a lot. Like that was my ace in the hole. If something was going really bad, I knew that I could bail myself out with a good fuck.
Everything else they put on the air. Yeah. You were doing a lot of celebrity interviews, and you're talking about celebrities that were, you know, are and still are, I mean, pretty cutting edge and sort of can be unpredictable. Did you have any moments that obviously made it to air, but were just like, what, I don't know what's going on here, or like I'm in the middle of a tornado and I'm just going to ride this one out, or, you know, just anybody
kind of... Well, you know, the one thing that I noticed is that there is, there's like an inverse... you would think that it would be a direct relationship, but it's more of an inverse relationship between like how big a star is and how difficult they are. To me, if I would, I had to go and do like a junket thing with Tom Cruise, and he was like the nicest and the easiest and would do anything that we asked him to do. And by the end of your 10 minutes with him, you think like, I think I'm friends with Tom Cruise. You know, like you're just like,
no,
you're,
yeah.
You know
yeah,
what I mean? Where it's just like, God damn it, this guy is amazing. And Jim Carrey, when he was on Top of the World, was just like the nicest and easiest.
Yeah.
And then you do a thing with like, you know, Kaya from The Real World Hawaii, and she's got a list of demands. And it's like, and she needs to sage her dressing room before anything can start. It's like, all right, what are you doing?
I had the same experience. I got fortunate enough to run into Paul McCartney at the Colbert Report where I was working, and we just started talking. He was literally, I come down the stairs, and he's standing in the hallway, leaning, he just finished rehearsal, all alone, leaning against the door jamb with one shoulder, looking up at the ceiling, chewing gum, like, all alone. And I'm like, this is fucking Paul McCartney. And I... Yeah. I have a rule, like, I don't go up and bother anybody because I don't want to be that guy, but I'm like, I got to, like, at least say hello and shake his hand.
So oh, I did it.
And yeah. he could not have been the nicest, like, hey, man, what's your name? Paul. Oh, yeah, it's a good name. What are you doing? I'm a comedian, blah, blah, blah. Host my old podcast. Oh, yeah, cool. Talk about 10 minutes, 15 minutes on the outside. I'm like, oh, cool. And on the inside, I'm like, I'm talking to Paul McCartney. I was like.
Oh, God.
And then I, because I'm delusional, go, I should ask, because I like to talk to people about their process and what they do, especially musicians, because I'm fascinated. I don't have that ability at all, and that people can hear all the music and the chords and the chorus and then put words to it. So I'm fascinated by it. So I just asked him, I said, would you do my podcast? And he went, yeah, sure. And I was like,
shut up.
Yeah. And then I go, and then I completely got like, you know when you always wanted to ask the hot girl, the hot guy out, whatever, and you didn't, and you said, you know, let me get this out of my system. I'll just ask. They'll say no, and I'll be done with this dream. But they say yes, and you don't have a plan. And he goes, yeah. And I'm like, he goes, how would we do it? And I literally was like, I'll come to London. And he goes, we're in New York. And then he goes to me, he goes, is it easy to do? And I literally said to, like, the most influential musician in the past century, yeah, we could, it's, I don't want to bother you. We could, you could do it on the phone naked from your toilet. I'm like, what the fuck am I saying?
Who is making this noise that's coming out of my mouth?
Yeah, exactly. And that's then amazing. The end of the story is I say, I'll go talk to your assistant. And he's like, nah, let's just exchange numbers. They'll muck it up. So he gave me his phone number. And then 2 hours later, yeah, 2 hours later, it was amazing. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And then you meet somebody.
Yeah. Well, that is insane. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Hey, did you work with Laura Kraft on the Colbert Report? Did you guys overlap?
No, not really.
Okay.
Wait. On Colbert or Daily Show?
On Colbert.
No, I did not. How do you know? Okay. How do you know Laura?
She's a friend of mine from the comedy world of L.A.
Oh, okay.
We did improv at the same place. She's a genius woman.
Is she in LA now?
Yeah, she is, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're hosting a thing, actually, this thing called Friday 40 at Meltdown.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
In fact, anytime you're in LA, please come be a contestant. It's a thing that we started a long time ago, actually, many years ago. It was me and my friend Scott Gimple, who is now the showrunner of The Walking Dead on AMC. Mm-hmm. So I rarely see him unless we're on stage together. But he is secretly the funniest guy in the world. And we came up with this sort of game show idea. We were both really big fans of Remote Control growing up in the 80s. Of that sort of like, you know, fun, anarchic kind of game show, half sketch comedy show, half game show kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So we came up with this show, which is 40 questions about the events of the last 7 days while everybody is drinking 40s of beer. Mm-hmm. So you sort of get a little loopy halfway through the show and whatever. And like sort of half of it is a traditional game show style. Half of it is our comedy friends coming up with characters and sort of interrupting like Weekend Update or Remote Control. And it ends up being a lot of fun. We started it at Upright Citizens Brigade, and then we did it at Improv Olympic for a few years, and now we're at Meltdown, which is Chris Hardwick opened this theater in the back of a comic book store on Sunset Boulevard, and it has turned into this sort of weirdly hip place to see comedy. So we do that once a month. I think the next one is September 12th. I don't know when this is coming out, but if any listeners are in the Los Angeles area, we'd love to see you.
Yeah, it's really cool. And how are you finding the audience members when they participate? Sometimes they're great, sometimes they can be, because they're not performers. Like, how does that play out?
Yeah. You know, it's, we try to have like comics and actors and stuff as contestants, and then we'll pick a person or two out of the audience to compete with them, like Price is Right style. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it really depends on where we are. Like, comedy theater audiences have a tendency to be, you know, I guess it kind of depends on the theater. Like Meltdown gets sort of a comedy nerd audience, which is great because they're respectful and they know what you're doing and they're not going to be jerks and yell. We did it recently at a theater on the West Side that attracts more of like a UCLA student or like, you know, bachelorette party from Riverside kind of a crowd. And it was a late night show and the whole audience was drinking and it was just 2 seconds in. We were both like, oh, this is going to be 90 minutes of pure hell for all of us. So let's just get through it. It can be terrible, but you know, it's good. Like, I'm still very much learning how to handle a live audience, and it's sometimes it's kind of good just to do a little trial by fire. But I started in New York way back in the day. In fact, I remember I was from my my first improv class ended up turning into like a group, and we would perform at like Rose's Turn and, you know, the Duplex and places like that downtown in New York. And our first, like, we went to audition for Aspen with, it was us and then the Bert Fershners, who were amazing. And then the original four Upright Citizens Brigade people before they opened their theater. And it was just it was immediately like, oh boy, we've got a long, long way to go. The minute Amy Poehler walked on stage, everyone was just like, oh boy, back to the drawing board. We're not going to get this. But
I mean, it's the kind of thing like that I would imagine helped you a lot. Like, as you were saying, you had the vamp as on camera, you know, in live moments. Just I would imagine that all that skill set came to bear, even subconsciously, in a way.
For sure. I mean, just the thing of, you know, yes anding, just sort of trying to just, you know, comment on what's going on around you and make something happen and be engaging. And you know, it's, improv is terrifying. You walk out on stage and you have no idea what's going to happen. So, once you've had the experience of having a great show and once you've had the experience of having a really awful show where you just have to sit in front of an audience that hates you and just eat shit for an hour, is like that's great. After you have both of those experiences, it's like, all right, well, nothing can scare me anymore, so bring it on, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing with stand-up.
Very helpful.
Like, you know, stand-up, like, from moment to moment, the audience can change on you, and it's like, well, wait a minute, where the hell did you just go? You were totally into this stuff, and now, you know, it's like wrestling a snake all slathered in, like, Crisco or something. You're, like, trying to get your hands around it, and it's like, and they have all the power. You just can't let them know it. Otherwise, they'll eat chew you up because, unfortunately, if audiences sense you need them too much, they'll be like, well, make us laugh. They're funny. You know what I mean? And there's that whole dynamic, which is... and you've been... What I've noticed, too, with you is you... Yeah. You've had, like, a lot of acting that you've been doing. Is that more kind of where you're putting your focus now?
No, not really. And it's... I've just sort of lucked into it. When Comedy Central picked up Reno 911 for a second season, and like word started to get around that they were gonna, because that first season was just the cast, like every part was the same seven people.
Right.
But then in season two, they started to cast a wider net, and I found out about that, and I was like, this was sort of my early days of doing improv in LA, and I was like, I was on a good team, and I was a little cocky, and I was like, get me on that goddamn show. I was like, I begged my agent. I was just like, just get me an audition. And I got an audition, and I went in, and it ended up working out, and they used me a bunch through like the rest of the show. I had a recurring part.
Leslie Frost,
which was just, God, such a joy to play. Like, the most terrified I've ever been, and the most fun I've ever had.
Why terrified? Terrified in what way?
Because I remember going out for my first scene that I ever did on that show, and it was me and Tom Lennon and Rachel Harris, who are the two funniest people in the world. Like, they're just effortlessly super duper funny. And I knew that they had put, you know, a good amount of faith in me, and I just didn't want to mess anything up. And I just remember, like, I had to do it was the two of them for a couple of minutes, and then I had to do an entrance. And I remember just sitting there looking at the monitor and thinking, like, I don't know, like, what am I doing here? What's, like, it just didn't make any sense. And like, I was so utterly petrified that it was almost like skydiving. Like, I don't know if you've ever jumped out of a plane, but there's a moment where it's just, you look out and you're just like, well, this is ridiculous, and there's nothing to do with jump. So that's what I did, and it was great. You know, like, I, you know, you can really overthink it, but, you know, luckily there wasn't time. It was time for my entrance, and I went, and we had fun, and they used me a bunch more, and then since then, like, really all my acting work has come from that. Like, a lot of people passed through that show, and so, you know, Tom and Ben, you know, this is a blessing, but they've really used me a lot. Like, every other thing they do, they pulled me in on. And so that's really great. And, but acting, no, I can't really say that I like that. I feel like Joe actor or anything. Like,
no,
like,
but you
know,
got
to work here and there.
It's like every year you've been Atomic Zoo, Self Storage, mm-hmm. Hell Baby, Ben and Kate
mm-hmm.
series.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's like every year you're doing something, which is a nice.
Yeah.
Nice to be able to kind of strap both the hosting side and the legit side.
It is, you know, I don't know that that's necessarily where I want to put my energy, but I'm never going to say no, you know, like if somebody wants to put me in something, I will always say yes. How about you? Where do you stand on that?
I kind of, I really like hosting. I've actually started to shoot this podcast as a television show. I just did Gilbert Godfrey here in New York, and did an hour with him, and then did an hour with Bobcat Goldthwait, who's like got a fascinating career trajectory in terms of, like, you know, just becoming a director and filmmaker now, and still performing, but just a different Bobcat than he was 20 years ago. And sure. So I really like that. I like talking to people. I like long form interviews. I kind of feel like it's funny because my mother had bad hearing. She still does. And you're probably saying, why do you bring that up? Because when I was a kid, she'd listen to Larry King radio show and it would be blaring in the house because she couldn't hear it. And I remember falling asleep to like Larry King. And I always loved, there was that deep voice in the middle of the night kind of thing. I don't know what it was, but it was even before he got on TV. I had a TV show and so I was always interested. I just like talk, but I also enjoy acting, you know, so I do like to try when I can get a part in something. I like to do that, but I do enjoy the hosting and the improvisation of that and the conversation.
Yeah.
I kind of think it's a lost art a little bit in terms of, you know, everything's so short form now, especially on network television, that the longer form kind of, like, other than Tavis Smiley and Charlie Rose, you know, so that's the nice thing about a podcast is you can do these kind of things, you know, and have these kind of conversations, which I like, you know.
Yeah. And, hey, did you see, it came out this week, that the old Dick Cavett episode with, it was Ben Gazzara and John Cassavetes and Peter Falk. They were there to promote Husbands, and they were all just visibly sloppy drunk, and they had sort of drunkenly come up with an idea that they were just gonna mess with Dick Cavett for the whole 45 minutes, and so it's on, like, the New Yorker did a piece on it, and the whole video is embedded on the article, and it's fascinating because they come off like total assholes, and Dick Cavett says that, like, the audience kind of turns on them halfway through, and they were all kind of chastened at the end of it, and they were all kind of you know, abashed around him for the rest of their relationship. But also, like, the fascinating thing about it is Dick Cavett, who I grew up with and always enjoyed and respected and whatever, but I was too young to really appreciate what he brought to the table. But watching him now as an adult, it's like he is so thoroughly a grown person. You know, he's so intelligent and so, like, nowadays I don't think he'd be able to do what he did on that show because he's funny-ish, but he's not really a comedian, and he's very smart. You know, it's not, you know, an informative show. It's just like he's a real character like you don't see anymore.
Yeah.
I will send you the link. Really,
I got to check that episode out. It's weird you should say that because 2 weeks ago I was working at home and I just had the TV on in the background. I think it might have been on AMC, but they had an episode of Dick Cavett interviewing Mel Brooks, and it seemed fairly recent, but I watched some of it, and you're totally right. Like, he's a really good interviewer, and he listens really well, and he's smart, but he's very subtle in his comedy, and so it's not like you're going to fall over out of your chair, but he's really good at it, and
he's clearly very clever.
Yeah, and I also think he was always in the shadow of Johnny Carson a little bit, you know, in the sense of
he
kind of was from that same kind of mold, you know, that proper Midwestern kind of thing. And I'll definitely look that up. That sounds great. I mean, there was a time, you know, I don't know whether it was fake or not. I do miss the times when guests would come out with tumblers of scotch and, you know, kind of smoking a cigarette.
Ah.
And there was a charm to that and a character that the show had as a result of that. But
yeah,
I feel it's missing a little bit now, you know, but... You know.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Everyone's, I guess, on Xanax or whatever now, and you can't see it. But,
they have the same agenda, you know, it's like... Do you feel like you... is your niche still the focus to, you know, to your hosting, to do so your own
well,
TV show where you're hosting something?
You know,
it seems like that's kind of where you have your feet planted.
My plan with doing this vulture column that I do was I love to write and still love Vulture. I think it's a really great website and I wanted to write for them. But then as I was doing it, my sort of plan was to sort of sneak some little moments of memoir into everything that I write. Just like, you know, it's a kind of a nostalgia column. It's like a top 40 from some important week in the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. And so writing about them, I really couldn't write about it without putting some of my own stories into it. And then also I thought, like, you know, I'm just going to see how much I can get away with, like how much memoir and these things I can get away with. And so I'd sort of sneak little pieces in. And I thought, if it's too much, my editor will, you know, take it out or whatever. But he never did. And it ended up being kind of what readers seem to respond to. So, so my plan was to sort of sneak that in and see if there was any interest in getting, you know, in me writing a longer form book, which is starting to happen now. So that is, I'm in the process of selling a book, which is sort of, you know, not quite a memoir, but sort of a essay collection.
Right.
And that, like, honestly, is the most excited I've been in a long time. Like, I love what I do, but it's, I've never really hunkered down and just focused on writing, and I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
I find it much more interesting and really entertaining, and it's and good opportunities are coming from that. Like, I'm starting to sort of have meetings about writing on shows and whatnot, and that's where I want to focus for the next 3 to 5 years. I'll still go out as a host for sure, because that's kind of, you know, like I still am sort of on that audition circuit, but I will say I'm getting less and less excited about the opportunities that hosts get now. You know, it's,
yeah.
you go out for, like, you know, Extreme Spelling Bee or whatever, and it's like, yeah, I don't know if that's necessarily where my head is at.
Also, there's more and more of these shows where they're reality-based, or they want an expert hosting it, right? So it's a guy who knows a lot about shrubs. It's the shrub show on the... and you don't know anything about shrubs. Get out. What's your knowledge?
I don't.
10 years ago, you wouldn't see breakdowns asking questions like that, you know, and now it's like, where do you see music? Obviously, I imagine you're passionate about music, and I know you've been involved in shows that have, like, really tried to promote truly indie bands that, you know, and musicians and artists that, like, people wouldn't know about. Like, are you sort of moving more away from music, and where do you see the music industry going with the internet and everything else?
You know, it's funny. I would say I'm 43, and the stock answer would be that, you know, music is moving away from me just because I'm getting older, and that's definitely true in some ways. Like, I turned on the Video Music Awards this last weekend because they were on, and I'm always gonna, you know, at least try to watch them. I didn't know who anybody was, but I also think, you know, things are so niche.
Yeah.
Everything is, you know, there's no one big thing anymore. It's all like a bunch of little things. So I think even young people would look at it in the same way. But also there's a weird phenomenon of like guys in their 40s making really great music. I am a huge fan of the Hold Steady, and they blow my mind. And they really didn't even start doing anything until they were like in their early mid 30s. They had done other things, but this particular project didn't start until they were all kind of up there in years. And I find that so inspiring.
Right.
There's a band called Wormburner that's sort of in the same vein. And it's, again, just like guys in their 40s. There's, you know, obviously Guided by Voices have never stopped. And I'm like really fascinated by guys who have a little bit, and women who have some actual life experience and have some wisdom. And it's, you know, it's less jarring to see, you know, guys in their 40s on stage playing guitars. Like, that would have been a weird sight in the 80s. But now I don't think it is anymore.
Right. You'd be that kid going, look at these old people. get a wheelchair. Yeah. Now you're exactly. Like, hey, that's not so bad. So that's a great perspective. Yeah, I didn't look at it that way, but so you still kind of keep one foot in that world a little bit, so to speak.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, still nothing makes me happier than like watching a really great band. I just had the this is crazy. I just came back from Spain. I was in Spain for a couple of weeks for a wedding and then just, you know, touring around. And luckily,
did you go to Barcelona? Everybody says, like, yep. Barcelona's
spent
amazing.
5 days in Barcelona, and it was the best.
You really got to go.
But the last night we were in town, we looked through the paper, and it was like, you know, there's got to be an American band playing somewhere. Let's go see. And it turned out Conor Oberst was playing, and I'm not like the biggest Conor Oberst fan, but I was like, well, maybe. And then I saw that his opening act was Dawes, who, I don't know if you've heard of Dawes, but I am obsessed with Dawes. They're fantastic. They're like a kind of a throwback to the 70s sort of Jackson Brown kind of sound, but like incredible lyrics. And I'm obsessed with them.
I got to check them out. I'm not familiar with them. I got to check them out.
They were playing last night in town. Yeah. And I just was like, oh, this is heaven. Like, that's still my favorite thing in the world is just, you know, being in a sort of medium sized venue, seeing a great band.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, I can't tell you enough how fun it's been to talk to you because I've known you from afar even when you were a chubby gay man, I thought, you know, hey, come on. September 12th is the next one.
The Friday 9:00
Meltdown, 9:00 in comics, right. Meltdown Comics in LA. Weekly column for Vulture. Really great, insightful writing. Smart and funny, and the kind of funny. Really, really well written stuff. I've been reading that for a while.
Panel,
game show podcast called International Waters, and a new podcast, gay theme podcast, coming out. What we talk about. So a lot to hear from you, Dave Holmes. Thanks for doing the show, man.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.